And a good Thursday morning to you. Welcome into the Nick Craig Show, streaming live this morning on YouTube, Rumble, and X. Don't forget you can take the show with you 24/7 on demand by checking out the Nick Craig Show in your favorite podcast app. You can also listen online by visiting the website nickcraig.com. Well, good Thursday morning to you. We start off with a pretty interesting story as it relates to appointment powers over the North Carolina State Board of Elections. If you'll remember back to December of last year, Republicans in the General Assembly passed Senate Bill 382. That bill included some relief for Western North Carolina, Hurricane Helene, and it also made some significant appointment changes to the governor's office. One of those changes was a change that would have allowed the state auditor, the incoming state auditor, and Dave Bolick to have control and appointment power over the North Carolina State Board of Elections. That was the law that was passed by the General Assembly. Democrat Governor Roy Cooper at the time vetoed the legislation. The GA, with a Republican supermajority, overrode it, and it became law. So with all of that said, the law was passed. It is on the books here in North Carolina. Senate Bill 382 is, in fact, enshrined in law in North Carolina. Well, obviously, Democrats were not a fan of this. The way that the Board of Elections is made up, you've, of course, got the State Board of Elections, the NCSBE, and then you've got 100 County Board of Elections. In the case of the NCSB, it's a five-member board. Three of the members appointed by the governor, two by the General Assembly. So with that, the party of the governor, in this case a Democrat and Josh Stein, has control over the Board of Elections. Part of that as well is that the party of the governor also controls all 100 local county board of elections. So there's a significant amount of power in the appointment over the Board of Elections with the governor's office. General Assembly wanted to change that and give it to the state auditor's office. Now, the argument here is that the General Assembly does not have the authority to change that. That's the argument made by Stein, made by folks on the left, is that the GA, the Republican-led General Assembly, does not have the authority to make that change. So with that, they started a legal battle. And yesterday, a three-judge panel, two Republicans, one Democrat, voted to block the GA's plan to shift oversight of the State Board of Elections to Dave Bolick. One Republican, one Democrat voting in favor of blocking that, while another Republican was the dissenting opinion. So with that, we were expected to see a change coming up 1 week from today, May 1st. Without court action, Bolick would have had the authority to make new appointments to the North Carolina State Board of Elections, and Governor Stein would have lost his power to appoint members to the election board. The panel yesterday granted Stein's motion for a summary judgment, which means that he wins the case without the need for a trial. They ruled after hearing arguments in the case back a couple of weeks ago. They decided we don't need a trial. We're going to go in favor of Stein. Dave Bolick responded to this yesterday saying, quote, "My office remains ready, willing, and able to take on the duties and responsibilities of overseeing the Board of Elections appointment and budget administration. I stand by my arguments and will promptly be appealing this ruling." So we're already hearing from Dave Bolick this morning that he, who is obviously one of the vested parties in this case, is going to appeal the decision that was given out yesterday by a three-judge panel in Wake County. Judge Edwin Wilson and Lori Hampton supported the decision. Wilson is a Democrat and Hamilton is a Republican. The third, Judge Andrew Womble, dissented. He is also a Republican. So with that, you've got a potential change that was going to take place, or not a potential, a change that was set to take place May the 1st. That is now not going to happen. The governor will continue with his appointment power. Now, this is obviously going to be appealed. Yeah, I just read you the comments from the state auditor in Dave Bolick, who is set to appeal this decision. Will this go directly to the Court of Appeals? Will this bypass the Court of Appeals and go directly to the Supreme Court here in North Carolina? Not exactly sure. I will remind you that the appeals court and the North Carolina Supreme Court do have an overwhelming Republican majority, so that could be interesting to see play out. But really, what's at hand here, and it's spelled out in Judge Womble's dissent to this. He says this, quote, The Constitution charges the governor with supervising the executive branch and its functions, while at the same time granting certain executive powers to other executive officers. In addition to the prescribed duties to an executive officer, our Constitution expressly recognizes the General Assembly's power to organize and reorganize the executive branch. He went on to say the Constitution likewise gives the governor specific guidelines by which he may influence the allocation of administrative functions, powers, and duties. Nonetheless, the text reverses the final authority for the legislative branch. Thus, while the governor has a general supervisory responsibility, each constitutional executive officer is primarily responsible for executing the laws assigned to that office by the General Assembly. So the argument being made in the dissent is the Constitution in the state of North Carolina does not say that the governor has control over the State Board of Elections. It does not say that. You can comb through and skim through the Constitution. There is nothing in there that says the governor expressly controls the State Board of Elections. Does not say that anywhere. Now, the two opinions in this case that were on the favoring side of Josh Stein claim that previous legal decisions, one back from 2018, that were dealing with similar changes to the Board of Elections, that is what they used essentially as their case law review to strike down this Senate Bill 382 from the North Carolina General Assembly. And why this is going to be appealed and why I think, I don't have any inside knowledge here, but while I believe and assume that both the GA and State Auditor Dave Bolick could be successful in an appeal of this case, is the Constitution does not lay out who is responsible for the State Board of Elections. Right? You look at so many other states, and obviously constitutions vary state by state. In many other states, it's the Secretary of State that has responsibility over the Board of Elections. That is a pretty common person that has that. Now, no state has the state auditor as the controlling party. That's unique to North Carolina. But the question at hand is not whether it's appropriate for the state auditor to have control. The discussion at hand is, does the Republican-led General Assembly have the ability to reorganize and reauthorize certain levels of the executive branch? My plain reading of the Constitution, reading some of the dissenting opinion in this from Judge Andrew Womble, indicates that yes, the North Carolina General Assembly clearly has the power to organize and reorganize the executive branch and dole out various authorities and various powers to, who I'll note, other statewide elected officials. State Auditor Dave Bolick didn't just randomly pop into this position. He ran a fierce primary debate campaign, then ran a very tough general election back in November of last year, and was successful in winning that race. Right? He's not just some random guy off the street that's taking control of the State Board of Elections. He is a duly elected member of the Council of State. Now, obviously, Democrats find themselves very frustrated with Dave Bolick because he's gone into state government and he's shaken things up. He has brought forth actions and plans to hold state government accountable for their actions. And with that, well, Democrats are not a fan. Democrats are not a fan of holding government accountable because they have been able to wield the power of government for their own political agenda, their own political incentives for decades now. Dave Bolick, who has the authority under the state auditor's office to look at state money, look at where money is being spent, look at where money is being doled out and everything associated with that, that's good work. That's work that seems to resonate with a lot of North Carolinians, a lot of voters across this state. So from my vantage point, Dave Bolick's done an absolutely phenomenal job in his position as the state auditor. Democrats see it a very different way because he is pushing back against years of unchecked government. He is pushing back against years of unchecked bureaucracy and unchecked bloat within state government. Democrats thrive on that unchecked power. Democrats thrive on that bloat. Meanwhile, you and I, the citizens of North Carolina, pay the price for that, right? Because we pay our taxes, just went through that process, last week, 2 weeks ago, with tax day rolling around, right? You and I have to bear the cost of those bureaucratical programs. You and I have to burden the responsibility of government spending. You and I are responsible for that. So Dave Bolick has done a very good job in the auditor's office. He's only been on the job a couple of months now. He's done a phenomenal job thus far. And this legislation, which, by the way, I'll note, was passed before he was sworn into office, looked to make those changes. It will be appealed, and it's going to be interesting to see as this makes its way to the Court of Appeals, potentially the state Supreme Court, whether the Republican-led General Assembly and their Senate bill does stay in place and does change some of those powers as it relates to the State Board of Elections. We'll keep an eye on it right here on the Nick Craig Show. Turning our attention to some international slash national news this morning, an exclusive piece running in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, the headline, White House considers slashing tariffs to de-escalate trade war. This being reported yesterday by the Wall Street Journal. It's a very interesting piece. Well, I just wanted to read through some of it this morning. It reads as follows. The Trump administration is considering slashing its steep tariffs on Chinese imports, in some cases by more than half, in a bid to de-escalate tensions with Beijing that have roiled global trade and investment, according to multiple people familiar with the matter. President Trump hasn't made a final determination, the people said, adding that the discussion will remain fluid and several options are on the table. One senior White House official said that the China tariffs were likely to come down to between roughly 50 and 65%. The administration is also considering a tiered approach similar to one proposed by the House Committee on China late last year. 35% levies for items the U.S. deems not a threat to national security, and at least 100% for items deemed as strategic to America's interests, some of the sources said. The bill proposed phasing in those levies over 5 years. As you can imagine, the White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Wall Street Journal. However, Trump did say Tuesday that he was willing to cut tariffs on Chinese goods, saying that the 145% tariffs that he imposed on China during his second term would come down, but, quote, it won't be zero, end quote there from the president. The development was welcome news to investors who had been spooked by the White House's aggressive moves in recent weeks. China on Wednesday signaled that it was open to trade talks with the U.S., though Beijing warned it wouldn't negotiate under continued threats from the White House. In China's policymaking circles, Trump's comments Tuesday were viewed as a sign of him folding, people who consult with Chinese officials said. Now, of course, that's how China is going to see it, and I'm sure that's how individuals on the left would like to say, oh, Trump is folding. But if he slaps a 65% tariff on China, not really sure how that's folding. And if he cowered into the corner and said, oh, no tariffs, if he recoiled and said, oh, no, nothing at all, we're going to come to the table with no tariffs on the table, no discussion of that at all, that would be somebody folding. But to bring the negotiation forward, to ratchet back the tariffs, and again, this decision has not officially been made by the president. And at the end of the day, it will be his decision whether they stay at 145%, whether they go to 100%, whether they move between the 50 and 65% range. A lot of ambiguity right now. But in order to negotiate, if the president feels that it is ambitious for him in the United States to lower some of those tariffs, to have some good faith negotiations with China, I don't see an issue with that. Right? And this is, of course, how the media will spin this whole thing. But let's look at what the actual goal of this whole thing was. It's not to have 145% tariffs on China. The goal of the so-called trade war is not to have 200% tariffs on China. It's to bring China to the table and renegotiate a better trade deal between the U.S. and China. Now, whether you agree with that happening or not, that was the end goal, Right. That's the objective, is to negotiate a better deal where China does not have the ability to do a 5-to-1 import to export ratio to the United States, where China is not able to rip off intellectual property here in the United States from U.S. companies and flood markets around the world with cheap knockoff goods infringing on U.S. copyright, infringing on U.S. intellectual property. To make a, what Trump claims, a more balanced trade deal between the United States and China. That's what the president has wanted. That's what he has telegraphed. He talked about it during his campaign. He's talked about it in the months now that he's been president. The goal is to bring everybody to the table and get a better deal for the United States. And if part of that deal is temporarily lowering these tariffs to bring China to the table, that's fine, because the end goal was not 145% tariffs on China. The expressions of openness to a deal from both sides represents a shift from much of the past month, as the world's two largest economies exchanged reciprocal tariff increases and testy words back and forth, helping push stock markets around the world to their worst weeks in many years. Of course, those have since recovered. The administration had planned to use ongoing tariff negotiations to pressure U.S. trading partners to limit their dealings with China. The Wall Street Journal previously reported still, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had said that there was room for talks on potential trade deals between the U.S. and China. Such talks would involve President Trump and the Chinese President Xi Jinping, though the two haven't talked since Trump regained the White House. So, seems like things are moving forward. You had these back and forth, tit for tat trade deals. You now have plus 135% tariffs from the China to the U.S. 145% tariffs from the U.S. to China. Right? Everybody has ratcheted the pressure up, and now it's going to be interesting, and it's going to be a time to see if they can come to the negotiating table and figure out a better deal. If so, then great. Then we have a better trade deal for the United States. If not, then I guess some of the continued frustration, some of the continued anger continues. And I was surprised to see, as this story came out yesterday, that a stock futures, which the stock market did pretty well yesterday, ended in the green. Futures are kind of mixed red this morning. Dow futures down 126 points. S&P futures down just 6.25 points. And then NASDAQ futures down just 23 points. So really not a whole lot of red. If you're looking at the loser in pre-markets, it is the Dow futures down 0.32% as this morning is set to kick off here in just about 2 hours or so. So that's really where things stand right now. No substantial movement or anything major on the stock market. But again, trying to bring individuals to the table. And that transitions well into another interesting story that we are tracking this morning, looking at some of the decisions, looking at some of the back and forth debate between Ukraine and Russia. This obviously has been something that the previous administration failed to deal with over multiple years. There was no discussions being made. There was no negotiation happening. The United States continued to write blank checks and bankroll the Ukrainians in a war in which they have no chance of winning, a war in which they were never going to hold off and quote unquote beat Russia. However, the United States continued to funnel money, and the entire time this war was going on, President Joe Biden had never picked up the phone and ever had a conversation with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Now, Vladimir Putin is a bad guy. Vladimir Putin is a dictator. Vladimir Putin is an authoritarian thug. All of those things are true. However, he is the president of a major country in the world. A major country that was at war with a much smaller country than Ukraine. You don't have to like the people you negotiate with, but you do have to negotiate with them. If you want to bring world peace, if you want to bring an end to a war, part of that is going to be discussing that with both parties. Now, Biden had plenty of conversations with Zelensky as he was just writing him blank checks. but he never bothered to have a discussion with the president of Russia, which I will stand by was a terrible decision to not open those lines of communication, to not have at least open some level of discussion was a huge failure on the behalf of the previous administration. There's been some discussion over the last couple of weeks that neither side is actually willing to negotiate a peace deal. Neither side actually wants this war to end. For the Ukrainians, they're getting pumped full of foreign money. For Russia, I don't know what their incentive is. Their troops on the front line have been whittled down to nothingness. The morale within the country is abysmally low. It's a mess for Russia. I really don't know what's going on here. However, President Trump commenting on Truth Social yesterday saying this, I want to read through his statement here. It says, the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is boasting on the front page of the Wall Street Journal that, quote, Ukraine will not legally recognize the occupation of Crimea. There's nothing to talk about here, end quote. Trump saying, quote, this statement is very harmful to the peace negotiations with Russia and that Crimea was lost years ago under the auspices of President Barack Hussein Obama and is not even a point of discussion. Nobody is asking Zelensky to recognize Crimea as Russian territory. But if he wants Crimea, why didn't they fight for it 11 years ago when it was handed over to Russia without a shot being fired? The area also houses, for many years before the Obama handover, major Russian submarine bases. It is inflammatory statements like Zelensky's that make it so difficult to settle this war. He has nothing to boast about. The situation for Ukraine is dire. He can have peace or he can fight for another 3 years before losing the whole country. I have nothing to do with Russia, but I have much to do with wanting to see to save an average of 5,000 Russian and Ukrainian soldiers a week who are dying for no reason whatsoever. The statement made by Zelensky today will do nothing but prolong the killing field, and nobody wants that. We are very close to a deal, but the man with no cards to play should now finally get it done. I look forward to being able to help Ukraine and Russia get out of this complete and total mess that would have never started if I were president. So you're continuing to see the frustration from President Donald Trump, continuing to telegraph concerns that, at least this morning, he's made similar comments about the Russian side, but yesterday pointing to the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, once again making ridiculous comments to the media, going all over the place and making comments here, making comments there about what's going on. This guy's nuts. And I think the president is very succinct in his comment. Zelensky can have peace or can fight the war for 3 more years, in which eventually Russia will completely take over Ukraine and it will once again become part of Russia. Right? That's the goal here. That's what the Russian president Vladimir Putin wants. And I find it so shocking that Zelensky is not shut up about this stuff. I find it remarkable that even after the situation a couple of months ago in the White House, in which he was laughed out of the Oval Office by J.D. Vance and President Trump, he continues to speak to media. In this case, he's talking about the Wall Street Journal this morning, continuing to speak to American media about the situation. Keep your mouth shut, get to the negotiation table, and sign a peace deal. Sign a treaty. Get this thing done. Now, the reality is, and Zelensky seems to be unwilling to wrap his head around it, and I presume the Russian president's having the same problem, neither side is going to quote-unquote win. There's not going to be a winner in this war. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. Russia, who is supposed to be this great military might, completely botched this invasion. Right? A story that should have lasted no more than a couple of weeks. If Russia truly wanted to take over Ukraine, they sure as hell have the military muster to do it. They failed miserably. which goes to show you that the strength of what was once a strong Russian military does not exist anymore. So it's for Vladimir Putin and the Russian, you know, oligarchy and the high ups in Russia, it is shows Russian strength. It's a huge ego hit to them, which they, of course, don't want to be expressed on the national stage at all. For the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, he's had hundreds of billions of dollars invested into his country. Half of the money is unaccounted for. Hundreds of thousands of people in his own country have died, yet he continues to not want peace, seemingly. Now, he might say he wants peace, but what he really wants is to, quote unquote, win. But nobody is going to win. You've got a war. Both sides are screwed. Ukraine can't battle this forever. They will eventually be taken over by Russia. It's a much larger country with a lot more resources. Eventually, if Russia wants, they could take over Ukraine. The spigot of money from the United States has been turned off for Zelensky. Right? He's no longer doesn't have another $300 billion worth of blank checks flowing into his country. So he's going to have to make a change. The fact that this deal has not yet been done, I think, goes to show you that both sides really are not super interested in taking over and dealing with some sort of peace agreement, some sort of peace deal. Because if they were, this could have been dealt with and done years ago, literally years ago. But for whatever reason, it wasn't. For whatever reason, previous leadership in the United States did not think it was important to bring these two parties together. For, again, whatever reason, I don't have the answer. Trump is trying to bring both parties, and for whatever reason, both sides seem to want to, continue to, at least from Zelensky, mouth off in the media, and from Putin's side, continue to indicate that somehow he is going to be the victor in all of this, and his ego, the Russian military's ego, is not going to be damaged, which, of course, it absolutely will. So, negotiations continue. Trump says, in all caps, get it done. We'll see if something like that happens over the next couple of weeks. Turning our attention to some local news this morning on the Nick Craig Show, we've got some details on a very interesting story out of Pender County. Before we get into that, I want to remind you that you can get daily show notes and more, including our monthly hangout, which will be happening next week on Wednesday, the final day of the month, April the 30th. You can head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig. $5, $10 a month, a custom amount if you believe that you are getting some value from the program. I encourage you to head on over to patreon.com/Nick Craig and support the show financially and get access to some of that bonus content. patreon.com/Nick Craig. Pender County commissioners voted earlier this week in closed session to fire their county manager, Michael Silverman, effective immediately. It's a pretty interesting story. The vote passed 3-2 with Dr. Jimmy Tate making the motion to fire Silverman, which was seconded by Commissioner Brent Springer. Commissioner Brad George also voted to fire Springer. Jerry Groves and Randy Burton voted no. In an email, Groves said he felt Silverman was, quote, the best, end quote, manager that Pender County had ever had. Pender County has appointed finance director Meg Blue as the interim county manager, according to a spokesperson. Silverman was hired for the position last April and began working in June of 2024. Hasn't even been on the job a year yet. A North Carolina native, he had previously served in some city management in a city in Mississippi. He had a base salary of $180,000 a year, according to a copy of his contract obtained on Wednesday. Jimmy Tate did return to the Board of Commissioners. He left that board in 2023, but was appointed to fill the position of Ken Smith back just a couple of weeks ago. Jimmy Tate told WECT News that the decision to fire Silverman had been on his mind since rejoining the board. Tate attributed the decision to firing the county manager's handling of the budget, wink, wink, nod, nod, right? We've spent all show yesterday talking about the budget, talking about the importance of local budgeting and strong staff within a county that is making those decisions. So the budget was one. Oversight of an ineffective process to create a merger plan between Pender County EMS and fire, and general lack of strength and assertiveness that included poor oversight over employees as well as new hires. Board member Tate told WECT News, quote, "I believe we needed stronger leadership." Tate said he followed the county's budget during his time away from the board and said that spending had increased tremendously as of late and that the county was saying yes to too many proposals. During Tuesday's meeting, Tate also introduced a resolution that passed unanimously to freeze spending and hiring through the remainder of the fiscal year, which will end June 30th of 2025. The new fiscal year kicks off July 1 of this year. During Tuesday's meeting, he said, quote, "Spending is out of control in our county, and I'm concerned about the amount of debt that we have." Despite the county trying to merge Pender EMS and fire within the next few months, Tate says commissioners still have no idea what the controversial merger will cost and are lacking specifics. He noted that he is very concerned about the status of the plan. Following up on that, Jimmy Tate said, quote, "When you have to probe and ask for information and consistently ask for follow-up information, that's very troubling to us when we are here to make critical decisions." Commissioner Tate is hoping that the county uses a national search to find its next county manager and will seek input from both county residents and staff, with Tate saying that the Pender County needs a manager with an economic development background. Specifically, he said he's looking for a manager who understands the entirety of the county, including its agriculture, coastal economic sectors, and also its growing tax base, as well as budgeting and how to get additional funding to roll into the county. Obviously, there's probably some additional details that did not make it to the news as it relates to the ongoings here. But when you've got a county manager that is losing the trust, or in some cases has lost the trust of their board of commissioners, that's a rough situation. And when you've got a county manager, at least from, you know, hearing some of the comments there from Commissioner Tate, when you've got a county manager that is not overseeing projects in an appropriate manner, when you've got a county manager who is not properly monitoring and managing staff and various employees within the county, that creates a big time issue. And so I guess that national search will continue. The finance chair and Meg Blue currently sits as the county manager. I'll be reaching out to Commissioner Tate in the next couple of days, see if we can get him on the show and talk about some of those decisions and some of his priorities for Pender County. As you know, you look at the growth in southeastern North Carolina, Pender is a huge county. I'm not sure, you know, if you look at it, on a map, Pender County is massive. I mean, it goes all the way essentially from Regalwood to Surf City. Now, I know Regalwood is technically in Columbus County, but it is a massive geographical county. Most of it, very rural. Most of the county is not densely populated. Now, you do have some more densely populated areas. Most of that happens to be towards the beach and towards Bergaw. But, I mean, just look at the size of Pender County. It's massive. It almost is as big as Brunswick. Not quite, but almost as big as Brunswick County. And so as growth continues in southeastern North Carolina, you can see New Hanover there at the bottom of the map. Geographically, not going anywhere else. The county is landlocked by the ocean on the east, the Cape Fear River on the west. The south spits out into the Atlantic Ocean, and to the north, you've got Pender County. Right? There's really nowhere else to go. The county in New Hanover is landlocked, and why you've seen so much growth in Brunswick and why you're likely to see some massive growth, some massive development in Pender over the next decade or two is because it's relatively close to the beach. You can go to Surf City and Hampstead and Topsail and North Topsail, all those beach communities relatively close by for folks in Pender County. And there's a huge amount of land available for growth and for development, and making sure that you know, the county is setting themselves up to be in a financially prudent situation going forward to make sure that individuals within that county, the various government entities and government agencies, that they have the ability to expand for that growth to take place. We will see exactly what happens, exactly what happens with some of that growth, with some of that expansion in Pender County. So the Pender County manager has been fired. We'll continue to track those details right here on the Nick Craig Show. We are going to be tracking a lot today as well. I will admit, if I sound a little hoarse, a little under the weather over the last couple of days, trying to save as much of my voice as possible for the two shows, the Carolina Journal News Hour and, of course, the Nick Craig Show. So that's going to do it for the program today. We'll be tracking what is expected to be another busy Thursday across the United States and here in North Carolina. We'll have all of you for all of that for you coming up tomorrow morning, live on YouTube, Rumble, and X, 7 a.m., and of course, 24/7, wherever you get your podcasts at thenickcraigshow.com. Have a great Thursday. We're back with you live tomorrow morning, right here.